This is a podcast from margaretthatcher.org.
Margaret Thatcher's Memoir of the Falklands War, Episode 3. On the morning of Tuesday 18th, we had a full committee, including all the chiefs of staff. We were somberly aware of the decision before us. We had to decide whether to go ahead with the landing, about which we had been briefed the previous week. Being aware of how much was unknown, and of the immense burden on us all, I knew that I had to ask each service chief to give his views and his judgment. The possibility of a peaceful settlement still existed, but expired late afternoon the following day. We must be ready if that happened. Each considered all aspects of the situation in full. Nothing was withheld. We should be vulnerable on landing. Had we enough air cover? British ships would be in range and their positions known. We had not been able to destroy as many ships or aircraft as we would have wished before the landing. We did not know where their submarines were. But, if there were delay, we could suffer more losses. Indeed, from our viewpoint and the condition of our troops, the sooner a landing took place, the better. The decisions we had taken to date had been right. We had excellent fighting forces, and the chiefs had every confidence in the plans of the force commander. None of them would quantify the possible casualties. It was not possible to do so. They were aware that if we held back now, Britain's military credibility would be severely tarnished. They considered that the advantages to be gained outweighed the risks, and the landing should be undertaken, as planned, by night. All rules of engagement had previously been agreed. We discussed these matters at length and questioned them on each aspect. We were unanimous in authorising the landing on the basis of the force commander's plan. We were told that we could stop it up to late Thursday, which enabled us thoroughly to consider any reply to the negotiations and to discuss and either cancel or reaffirm after Cabinet on Thursday morning. Apart from that, the timing was for the force commander. At the United Nations, Mr. Pérez de Cuellar was handling matters with great privacy, which was very necessary, and diplomacy. We were indeed fortunate to have such a skilled Secretary-General. We were to have a cabinet meeting later that day about the draft agreement and then, subject to their consent, lay it before Parliament on the 20th of May. It should be accompanied by a commentary describing the UN negotiations. On Wednesday, the UN handed over to us the text of an Argentine reply to our proposals. They amounted to a rejection of our paper. In a last-minute bid to avert a breakdown, the Secretary-General presented his aide memoir to us and to Argentina, setting out his proposals. On Thursday morning, our committee met before Cabinet. The authorisation to land stood and, subject to Cabinet, would go ahead. But once again, the Foreign Secretary suggested that as the Secretary-General's aide memoir had considerable similarities to our own proposals, the world wouldn't understand if we went ahead with military measures. The fact was that the Secretary-General's proposals were sketchy and obscure, and we could have been right back near the beginning again. The object from the Argentinians' viewpoint was delay. I summed up very firmly. There could be no question of holding up the military timetable. It could be fatal for our forces. If the weather was right, the landing went ahead. The committee, and later Cabinet, agreed. How then to arrange matters so the world did not conclude that a landing was imminent? Fortunately, by that time, we had had the enormously successful commando raid on Pebble Island, so we deliberately set out to give the impression that we should continue for some time with such raids. The press never forgave us, but we had to do it. Fortunately, the SAS had destroyed 11 aircraft in a fantastically bold operation in terrible weather. On that Thursday, the Secretary-General, having received no reply from the Argentinians about the aide memoir, declared that his peace efforts had come to an end. The debate in the House went well. We awaited the weather. An anxious day and night were ahead. I had a full day's engagements in the constituency on Friday, and knew how vital it was to carry on with business as usual. Ironically, I had to open a major extension of Gerson's, who specialised in storage and international movement and packaging. Over 1,200 people had been invited, including many ambassadors. The band of the guards was there, and speeches, etc. were expected. What could I say but that 8,000 miles away was really only a heartbeat away, and that it was for all our people, not only those whose family were in the task force. One felt the whole audience with us. It was a matter of pride, respect, conviction, and being free that meant we must restore the Falklands. Somehow, I inspected everything, rode on a forklift truck, had lunch in an enormous warehouse, and then fled to the office to see if there was any news. Not yet. Of course, there was more to do than to let us know what was happening. I returned to my Finchley office again soon after 5 p.m, and in concealed language understood that events had happened, but no more news. Then it was given on TV, and the emotion at a reception in Woodhouse School that night was overwhelming. The Union Jack was flying in San Carlos Bay. We had returned to the Falklands. My heart was full, but desperately anxious about casualties. We had landed on a hostile coast on a winter's night with a fleet of ships full of men and equipment. Was it possible that we had not been detected? I left soon after I had spoken to return to Number 10. John Knott came in with a full report. The actual landing had been achieved without a single casualty, but daytime was now, and of course attacks were fierce from the air. How they missed the White Canberra is a miracle. We got her away the following night. But from then on, we went into a different level of conflict. The ships were in known positions, and all our air cover had to come from Hermes and Invincible, which themselves had to stand off a long way. The Rapiers were being unloaded as fast as possible, but there were dangerous hours ahead. Argentine air attacks on Sunday were heavy on ships in Falkland Sound and San Carlos water, and again on Monday and after. It was a desperately anxious time for everyone. HMS Antelope was very seriously damaged, and then HMS Ardent. Thanks to brave rescue operations, the loss of life was less than might otherwise have been. Many Argentine planes were shot down, but there were many more to come. Tuesday and Wednesday, 24th and 25th of May, were especially bad days. I was at the house working in my room when John Knott came in to say that HMS Coventry had been the subject of attack by a wave of aircraft. Six or more had continuously bombarded her, and she was sinking. He had to be on TV within half an hour, and as he appeared, the news had got through, although the name of the ship was not known. It was thought better not to reveal it until we had more details about losses. Whether the decision was right or wrong, I do not know. The effect was that every Navy family was anxious. The loss was announced next day. That same evening, later, when I went into the office to find the latest news about Coventry, the duty clerk told me that Atlantic Conveyor had been hit by Exocet missiles, was on fire, and orders had been given to abandon ship. How many more tragedies could there be? How many losses could we suffer? I knew also that aboard the Atlantic Conveyor had been 19 Harriers, reinforcements that were sorely needed. Were they still on board? If so, and we had lost them, could we carry on? And she was also carrying helicopters which we should need for bringing supplies to the troops as they moved forward from San Carlos. To add to one's dismay, there was news that Invincible had been hit and received some damage. Perhaps that was the worst night of all. And somewhere east of the Falklands was the QE2 carrying 3,000 troops. Early next morning, I waited for news. A remarkable rescue from Coventry and the Atlantic Conveyor, although, as we discovered later, her remarkable captain was lost. Fortunately, the 19 Harriers had previously been flown onto Hermes and Invincible. Relief flooded on me at that news. We were not fatally wounded. We had lost 8 helicopters, but the military chiefs assured me that we had planned supplies to expect some losses. And we had lost 4,500 winter tents, many of them to accommodate prisoners of war. And the news that Invincible was hit or damaged was totally false. So we learned the deep sorrows of war, but we had to go on to complete the task. Stores were being unloaded well at San Carlos. Some landing and supply craft were hit, and there were unexploded bombs, most of which were diffused. Our hospital at San Carlos was hit, but the doctors carried on marvellously. The local people had given our troops an enormous welcome and couldn't do enough for them. One of the local young men, who I met later, had taken his tractor and shown our boys the way to Teal Inlet and across to Mount Longdon and the entrances to Port Stanley. Only when I flew over the ground did I realise what a long yomp it was, and how remarkable that the paras and marines and guards had achieved it. It had been several days since the landing. On TV, there had been discussions about whether the next strike would be through Teal to Stanley or through Darwin. We were all concerned that there appeared to be little movement out of the bridgehead, and yet we knew the decision had to be taken by the local commander according to his stores, the weather, his reconnaissance and his judgment. General Moore had not yet arrived at San Carlos. We remained grievously concerned at the naval losses and aware that the surface Argentine Navy had retreated into 12-mile territorial waters. As two of our ships had been sunk in our territorial waters, we tackled the Attorney General. Could we not sink theirs in their territorial waters? There were parts of the coast where the water was deep enough for our submarines to operate. But time and again the Attorney General said no. Once they moved out and into the direction of the Falklands, yes, but not unless. Our submarine commanders were left prowling up and down the line, very frustrated. And we knew their navy could make a sudden sally, and we might not then find them quickly enough to stop the harm they could do. In the committee, we turned our political attention to the longer-term issues. How to deal with POWs. How to secure a permanent cessation of hostilities. At what stage did we call on the Argentinian commander to surrender? By the weekend, Darwin and Goose Green had been taken. It was a bitter and difficult battle. The positions of the enemy were very well prepared and dug in. Our paras had to advance over a narrow isthmus in face of heavy fire. At one point it seemed impossible to break through. At that time Colonel H. Jones made his famous courageous advance. His Victoria Cross life was lost, but his bravery was the turning point in the battle. His second-in-command took over and eventually secured the surrender. It had not been easy for him, because at one time a white flag was waved from the Argentine trenches, and when two of our troops went forward in response, they were shot at and lost their lives. Finally, our commander sent two Argentinian POWs forward with a message to surrender, saying they could have a parade if they liked, but they must lay down their arms and surrender. They did. They lined up. Their officers harangued them about their just cause, but they surrendered. The people of Goose Green, who had been pinned in the community hall for 3 weeks, were released. And a great and decisive military battle was won. Today there is a memorial to the paras on the ridge near Goose Green. The press had reported that Darwin had been taken 2 days before the victory. Can there ever have been an army that had to fight its battles against media reporting like that? I had been very angry when I heard on early morning BBC radio that the QE2 was near South Georgia transferring troops to three ships, the Canberra, Norland and a third. I knew this was planned, but it was devastating to hear the report at about the time it was due to take place. Within 8 hours of that broadcast, reconnaissance planes were over South Georgia searching. They had not been there for weeks. Fortunately, they did not find the ships. The sea is a big place. Once again, the Canberra went into San Carlos with her precious cargo, and once again she slipped out unharmed. At Goose Green, stocks of napalm bombs were discovered. By early June, Spain and Panama had tabled ceasefire resolutions in the Security Council. There had, of course, been efforts, initially in our own House of Commons, for me to leave our negotiating terms on the table, even after a landing. This I absolutely refused to do. How could we ask our own armed forces to risk their lives only to contemplate a withdrawal if the Argentines wanted to play it that way? Once we went in to complete the task. But the UN was at it again. A ceasefire was called for. I was constantly saying a ceasefire must be accompanied by a total withdrawal of Argentine troops. Tony Parsons fought our case splendidly, but a new resolution was certainly underway. There was a great move to urge us to appeal to Galtieri to withdraw before the final assault on Port Stanley, or to pause before we made that assault. It seemed to me this could put our troops in an intolerable position. We were in the midst of winter, and it was essential to repossess with all possible speed and to wait for nothing. By 4th of June, all Argentine POWs from Goose Green were on board MV Norland waiting to be repatriated. Some had been treated in our military hospital at San Carlos. Our doctors had been very critical of the fieldwork of their doctors. That weekend began the Versailles Economic Summit, attended by the Chancellor, the Foreign Secretary and myself. I went to Paris first to see President Reagan, who was staying at the US Embassy. We had quite a talk together, à deux, as he preferred it. I thanked him for the enormous help we had received from the US and asked that the US vote should follow ours at the Security Council and whether the US could give us any help with repatriating Argentine POWs after the retaking of Port Stanley. I also asked him what he wanted out of the summit. It was plain that above all he wanted an agreement about trade with the Soviet Union on both unsubsidized interest rates and a lower percentage of the orders to be provided by credit. I thought we could help on both by supporting him. The question of the John Brown turbines for the Siberian gas pipeline had already arisen several times, and there was an understanding that if we agreed the President's interest and credit terms for trade with the USSR, then contracts already agreed would go ahead. Alas, as events happened, things went badly wrong on that score. All foreign secretaries and finance ministers had agreed a text on the first day of Versailles, which was virtually what the President wanted. It came before heads of government the second day with President Mitterrand in the chair. He didn't like it and proceeded to unpack the whole deal. I was trying to get a satisfactory compromise the whole time, but it wasn't possible. To add to our troubles, that morning the Israelis had invaded the Lebanon, and Al Haig, who was sitting next to me, was trying to arrange a visit to Tel Aviv that night or the next day. After my talk with President Reagan in Paris, we all arrived at Versailles, where we were staying in the Petit Trianon. That evening after dinner, all heads of government dined together, we had a long discussion about the Falklands. I could not indicate how long it would require to take Port Stanley, but said I hoped within the month. They thought this a long time, longer than they had imagined from the viewpoint of sanctions. However, they were most helpful about what they could do to get a permanent ceasefire. I explained about plans for POWs, and suggested that, as under the Geneva Convention, we did not have to return them until hostilities had ceased, it might be possible to retain them until Argentina had agreed to a permanent cessation. Helmut Schmidt thought those present might help to that end. If we kept in touch, possibly all seven could join in bringing pressure to bear on Argentina. I left the evening feeling pleased with their cooperation and duly reported this conversation to officials. We had each delegation been allocated a sitting room. Mine had previously been the King's bedroom and had had the bed removed. It was a large, richly furnished room with windows straight out onto the terrace. We had only been sitting there talking for about 15 minutes when a message came from the FO and Tony Parsons that a vote was about to be taken in the Security Council and the Japanese were voting against us. As they were the ninth vote required for the resolution to pass, this was particularly irritating. So much for the previous cooperation. We tried very hard to get on to Suzuki, who could not possibly have gone to bed in such a short time, to get him to reverse the decision and at least abstain, but we were unsuccessful. Meanwhile, more political drama. Mrs. Kirkpatrick had received instructions from Haig to follow us with her vote. She had done so. Then, from Versailles, Haig had phoned telling her to withdraw that vote. She applied to change it but was not able to do so. Feathers were ruffled all round. The fact was that Al Haig had succumbed to pressure from other Latin American countries. I talked to Suzuki the following morning, who gave me a very lame explanation. As the motion had incorporated 502, they thought it would lead to Argentinian withdrawal. We had lunch in the palace, heads of government and foreign secretaries all together. Before we started, the TV cameras were allowed in. Inevitably, the US interviewer tossed a question to President Reagan, asking him what had happened to the vote at the UN the previous evening. Poor Ron, he knew nothing about it, to my amazement. He just said, "I'm afraid you've got me there. I don't know anything about that one." The interviewer turned to me. Cross as I was about it, I wasn't going to have a row on the media, so merely said I didn't give interviews over lunch. But alas, it all went out over the world's TV sets and created a very bad impression. What was very good about Falklands vis-à-vis Versailles was President Mitterrand's summing up at the press conference the next day. He agreed absolutely with what we had done. Britain must recover her islands. He was most understanding and splendid throughout. There was a grand and beautiful banquet in the Hall of Mirrors, which I attended, but left before the opera and the fireworks. I had to get home, and it would not have been right to stay for such revelry. All my thoughts were of what was happening in the South Atlantic. By this time, General Moore was in charge from his headquarters in San Carlos, and his problem was to get enough equipment and ammunition forwards before the final assault on the ring of mountains which protect Port Stanley. On the Monday morning, 7th of June, there was much to attend to. I had to report the Versailles proposal that other governments were prepared to help in putting pressure on Argentina for a permanent cessation of hostilities, and that the US was quite anxious to help with the logistics of evacuating POWs. There had been some military problems. Our Vulcans had been trying to knock out some very well-established Argentine radars that were reporting all our aircraft movements and could pinpoint the position of the aircraft carriers. The Vulcans had been carrying special anti-radar weapons. One had failed to release, or had not been released, and the refueling probe had broken on the return to Ascension. The Vulcan had therefore landed in Brazil and been impounded with its weapon. There were also reports from our ambassador in Chile about Chilean troop movements, which turned out to have no significance at all. Astith had finally been questioned by French and Swedish governments, had refused to answer, and we therefore agreed to repatriate him by air to Argentina. Early that week, we had another terrible, heart-rending hazard of war. General Moore had sent Sir Tristram and Sir Galahad with men, equipment and munitions round to Bluff Cove and Fitzroy. They would normally have gone by helicopter, but the weather was not sufficiently good to get enough quantities of stores and impedimenta in time. The ships arrived at Fitzroy and were unloading the Rapier battery to protect from air attack. The clouds cleared, and there was a sudden Argentine air attack which scored a direct hit on Sir Galahad, causing great loss of life and terrible fires and burns. The Welsh Guards took the brunt of it. There are if-onlys throughout life, and if only the men had been taken off and dispersed first, the casualties would never have been suffered to that extent. General Moore was grief-stricken. I was up at Northwood a day after. We all felt, how many more? Once again, we had very difficult decisions to make about releasing news of casualties. Rumours of very large numbers, several hundreds, spread like wildfire, and relatives were naturally alarmed and frantically worried. We had to hold up details for days. We knew from intelligence that the Argentines thought the casualties were several times worse than they were, and that the blow would hold up our attack on Port Stanley. In spite of criticism, we refused to reveal the numbers, but as fast as we could we informed all next of kin. We knew the attack on Mount Longdon, Two Sisters and Wireless Ridge was due to begin on Friday night, and surprise was vital. Friday night, 11th of June, came. Early on Saturday morning, the duty clerk came up to the flat with a note in his hand. I almost seized it from him, expecting news that the attack had begun. But it was more bad news. HMS Glamorgan had been bombarding the Argentine positions in Port Stanley and on the hills prior to battle. We had agreed that the cathedral in Port Stanley would be sanctuary, but not all the people went there, and three civilians were killed. Glamorgan had been hit by a land-based exocet and was on fire. She was steaming away from the scene of battle at 12 knots. Casualties, some killed, had been suffered. It is impossible to describe the depth of feeling at these times. It is quite unlike anything else I have ever experienced. In fights for liberty, we lose our bravest and best. How unjust and heartbreaking. Now we know the sacrifices that previous generations made for us. And at number 10, one was protected and safe. One felt so guilty at the comfort. That day, Saturday, the colour was trooped for the Queen's birthday. It poured with rain, and somehow that seemed fitting, although unpleasant, for the guards. I wore black. There was much to mourn. John Knott arrived shortly before we were due to take our place on the stand. Had he any news, I inquired. None, beyond what I had. But he thought we would have known if the attack had not started. Rex Hunt and Mrs. Hunt were with us, all anxious for news. We went to the trooping and came in with all possible speed for news afterwards. All the guests were dripping wet. We dried out before the fires as best we could. Shortly before 1 p.m. we heard that all objectives had been achieved, but there had been a stiff battle for Two Sisters. The plan had been to press on to Tumbledown, but it was decided to wait a time. I went up to Northwood in the afternoon to hear precisely what had happened. There was better news about Glamorgan. She had got the fires under control and was steaming at 20 knots. The next stage was for the Scots Guards, Tumbledown, and then the Gurkhas, Sapper Hill, the last hill before Port Stanley. The committee met on Monday morning, 14th of June, too early for news except that we knew the battle was in progress. It was indeed fiercely fought. Just how fiercely I learned when I visited it nearly 7 months later and walked the ground in early morning in the driving rain and wind. The whole area is covered with outcrops of rock which make natural fortifications. I was there at first light. They took it by night and in the sleet and snow. A stupendous feat. And once again, at a critical stage in the battle, the future depended on the courage and professionalism of the officer in charge. What happened later that day seemed like a miracle. The Argentines retreated not only from Tumbledown, but from Sapper's Hill as well. They threw down their arms and were seen picking their way through their own minefields into Port Stanley. Hours followed them, and Colonel Rose went to see Menendez about a complete surrender of West and East Falklands. We received news. The white flags are flying over Port Stanley. We dared not hope too much too soon. I wrote out a brief statement for the House. By the time I rose at 10 p.m. on a point of order, we knew that General Moore had reached Government House and was negotiating with Menendez. The House cheered. Downing Street was full of people, young people. It was their generation who had done it. Today's heroes. Britain still breeds them. As I went to sleep very late that night, I felt an enormous burden had been lifted from my shoulders, and future worries would be small compared with those of life or death which had been with us constantly for 11 weeks. It was a miracle wrought by ordinary men and women with extraordinary qualities. Forever bold, forever brave, forever remembered. Much later, at the memorial service at St. Paul's, where the roll of honour containing every name of those 257 who gave their lives, the mother, a Glasgow lady, who had lost her dearly loved son, suddenly took my arm and said, "You'll never let the islands go, will you?" "No, never," I replied, a promise I gave as Prime Minister, and which I hope will always be honoured for the sake of those who died. There were many things yet to be discussed and decided. The Argentine POWs. The fact was we couldn't look after them properly on Falklands. The tents we had intended for use went down on the Atlantic conveyor. We had to return them to Argentina as soon as proper arrangements could be made. Any bargaining about permanent cessation proved fruitless. Eventually, we counted 11,848 prisoners and put them aboard Canberra and Norland. Argentina agreed safe conduct for them to go to Puerto Madryn. The Argentinians still had one of our POWs, Flight Lieutenant Glover, and three British journalists. Southern Thule had to be recaptured. This was done without a shot being fired. The Argentines there had not been engaged in scientific activities other than meteorological observations. Arrangements had to be made to repatriate the bodies of servicemen killed on Falklands for those relatives who wished it. A number, including H's widow, wished the bodies to remain in the Falklands. Offers to Argentina to repatriate their dead. Return of Rex and Mrs. Hunt and some teachers, Falklanders who had been in Britain as soon as possible. We made it clear that Security Council Resolution 502 was dead because the Argentinians had not implemented the operative paragraphs. There was therefore no obligation on us to withdraw. After we had repatriated the vast majority of the prisoners, some 560 officers and skilled men remained, including General Menendez. Some helped to mark the minefields which were and will remain a major hazard for years. We captured large amounts of equipment, but only some of it was usable. We had to recover the Shrike radar missile from Brazil. The Vulcan was returned to Ascension. Admiral Woodward and General Moore had to be relieved and replaced. Ships, including aircraft carriers, had to come home, to a tumultuous welcome. I went to meet Hermes. She is a fantastic ship. To go below and see how the Harriers and helicopters had been packed in was a great experience. The men who worked on maintenance had kept more aircraft flying than we ever imagined was possible. And the hospital ward, where men from Sheffield and Coventry had been taken, was its own miracle chapter. Captain Middleton himself was an inspiration. Rehabilitation work. prefab houses, army units, building equipment, rock crushers, supplies of every kind, money for compensation for the Falklanders. All had to be arranged and put in hand. And, of course, the service of thanksgiving and remembrance in St. Paul's. This had its own difficulties because of its ecumenical nature. No parade was allowed to the cathedral, no colours to the altar, and it was as much as we could do to persuade the church authorities to allow anyone who had taken part in the Falklands campaign to take part in the service. Eventually, after a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, they agreed that two junior members of the armed forces should speak some sentences and the para-chaplain should take part by reading a lesson. The Thanksgiving part was virtually dropped from the service. But because of the presence of the Queen and all the royal family, and the superb pageantry of the military band and trumpeters, the service was a great comfort to the bereaved, and that mattered more than anything else. At one time it was suggested that the service should contain elements to appeal to Argentine opinion, such as the Lord's Prayer in Spanish. It was also indicated that certain of the clergy would not take part if members of the armed forces read the lessons. I threatened to make this known in Parliament, and therefore publicly. Arrangements for a South Atlantic Fund on charitable terms, which involved the established service charities and which avoided the criticisms of the kind which occurred over the Penley lifeboat disaster. Restoration and improvement of the airfield with the matting we had purchased from the United States. The Royal Engineers did a superlative job, as I discovered when I visited them. Flight Lieutenant Glover was repatriated to Montevideo on 8th of July. We were anxious to return the rest of the Argentinians, something we achieved very soon after. Following that, financial restrictions were lifted, but the Argentinians refused to allow flights to Buenos Aires as part of the package. Following these matters, the Franks Committee was set up with the agreement of the opposition parties and reported within 6 months. Within 1 year, we had arranged for some 500 of the bereaved to visit the Falklands, a traumatic and profound experience for them. To overcome evil requires the bravest of men.